This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. Join our conversation on our website, WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. As a matter of fact, right now, if you go to Facebook, you can find us on Facebook Live, where we'll be streaming all hour long. You can also call us at 860-275-7266 if you want to talk about the news of the week. We are joined, as always, by Colin McEnroe. He's the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Howdy, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky.
Also with us is Susan Bigelow, a contributor to CTNewsJunkie.com. Hello there, Susan.
Good morning.
And back with us for the first time in a while, but we're very glad to have him, Jerry Brooks. He's the former news anchor at NBC Connecticut. You may have heard he retired. I don't know if anybody had made a big deal of that, Jerry, but you retired last week.
I did?
No,
that's why
you.
I couldn't get in through the gate the last couple of days.
We'll congratulate you a little bit more on your retirement, but it's great to see you
really,
once again.
That's enough.
We're doing an on-field presentation of a chair we made for you.
Yeah, exactly. It's just Carlos Mejia and Scott Brady were out there in the wood shop. It's actually
that's
a
very
nice rocking chair. Let's start our show by pulling apart this notion that's become seen as gospel truth in our state. People are leaving. High taxes are the reason. Young people are leaving, too. And the fact that the state's no fun is the reason that we hear. To some extent, politicians from both parties have used these truths in their campaigns, but especially Republicans who basically ran on this idea in November and got fairly well spanked in both the governor's and legislative races. The Hartford Courant put out an editorial that said, you know, here are six census numbers that are actually pretty good for Connecticut. They say in 2017, about 15,000 Connecticut residents from 30 to 39 in that age group moved to other states, but a little bit more than that, about 16,000 moved in. They've got some other numbers that suggest that maybe things aren't so bad. But I don't know, Colin, it does push back against some trends that we have seen for some time in which it's clear there is some out-migration from Connecticut. I cover the entire New England region on Next in the New England News Collaborative, and we're not alone in that. You know, our region is losing people. We're getting old pretty fast. We're not finding replacement workers. So how true is this whole thing where Connecticut's kind of a bad place to live, too high taxes, and people are just fleeing left and right?
Yeah, I mean, how true is it is a really good question, and maybe not one that has a terribly easy answer, just in the sense that a lot of this data really needs to be looked at a pretty granular level. For example, one place that a lot of people move to from Connecticut is Massachusetts. They're certainly not moving to Massachusetts because of the great tax policies there. I would also say, you know, older couple moves from Connecticut to Vermont is pretty much dog bites man. I don't like that's just been going on forever. It really shouldn't be a big story anymore. I think the truth is there is still an out-migration problem. There's still a net out-migration problem unless you count people moving here from foreign countries, in which case there isn't. And every statement you make about this is kind of like that statement. This is true unless you factor for this. This seems to be a problem unless you look at this other aspect of it. And I don't mean to minimize the problem of population loss. But I don't think it makes the kind of easy political slogan that it's been turned into, at least not at a truthful level. I don't think it ultimately can be explained in one very simple way.
I will say, Susan, that one of the reasons we wanted to pull this apart today is because we want to forensically look at what exactly happened to the GOP in the state legislature, what happened to Bob Stefanowski's campaign, both of which were predicated in the ideas. You're going to have Democrats in there. They're going to raise taxes. It's going to be an awful dystopian hellscape that you will have to flee in order to protect your assets. And that didn't necessarily resonate with voters. I will say, I mentioned this in the opening, that there is another line, and often Democrats say this, which is, we don't do enough to prop up our cities and to make them vibrant places. The reason that kids move to high tax and high cost places like Boston or New York is because they're fun. There's things to do. There's high paying jobs there. So that's something that probably requires a little bit of tax income. So in some ways, this narrative that we tell ourselves about Connecticut being a terrible place to live that people are fleeing kind of comes from both sides, not just one.
Oh, we love to tell ourselves how terrible it is here. That seems to be the Connecticut way, is to just wallow in our own despair as much as we possibly can. We're a really fun kind of people. but it's always going to be more complex than people think. It's always going to – the narrative, of course, is that this is not a great place. It needs to either change or we need to leave it. But, of course, it's more complicated than that. People are coming and going for lots and lots of different reasons. There's a lot of reasons to be optimistic about Connecticut that we really don't do a very good job, like you said, of promoting. Our cities are actually a lot more fun than I think people give them credit for. I think if you look at the downtown housing boom in Hartford, for example, it's pretty interesting what's happening in the cities. Well, you know, there's also jobs here that are very attractive to young people, manufacturing jobs, for example. There are some high-tech jobs as well. So it doesn't fit neatly into our sort of low self-esteem problem. It also doesn't fit neatly into a political narrative for either side.
How do you view this narrative, Jerry? Because it's something that we've been hearing about for a long time. And the only thing from a political standpoint I can think about is it's going to be really hard to win elections over the long term if the story that you're telling is this is a really terrible place. And I think that that's a little bit too much of what we heard from one of the two parties this time. But both parties, as Susan said, are guilty of it over the course of our political history.
I stayed here for 44 years. So how bad can it be, first of all, from my standpoint? But, you know, I read the current editorial and it was like, it's bad, but it's not as bad as you think. So, you know, don't get too upset, but we should still be a little upset. And, you know, I left that editorial thinking, why did you waste your time doing this? Hey, I'm in a unique position. Not unique. I hate that word. I'm in a position where at 66 years old, newly retired, not having the income that I did, what do I do now? My immediate solution and resolution is stay right here because it is a good place to live. Ultimately, we'll see how the financial situation evolves. And, you know, if I have to buy white shoes and a white belt and, you know, go down south, whatever.
But I mean, one of the solutions is that you would write a strongly worded letter to the editorial, of which the Current publishes many, someone who says something that sounds an awful lot like, I raised my kids here and in the great public schools, and I built a good life here. And now, as I turn 66 or whatever, it's time to say goodbye to Connecticut because it's far too expensive a place to live. And I'm struck by how many of those stories we seem to hear anecdotally, whether or not the numbers actually back it up.
Well, I read the one in The Current yesterday with a guy. As soon as I'm finished with the obligations to my 99-year-old father, which was a really lovely way of saying, I'm waiting for this guy to die so I can get the heck out. You know, we've all invested too much here to just walk away. You know, there are solutions. They are going to take much more time than I have to give the world. But, you know, I think the state is worth working toward a resolution to maintain the lifestyle that many of us have enjoyed quite nicely.
I think it's significant that two of the people in the gubernatorial field who kind of ran on this dystopian hellscape notion had recently moved back here. Bob Stefanowski had been living in London, then he moved to Philadelphia and commuted on the weekends up to Madison, and then in 2017 he really went all in and moved back up to Madison and then ran for governor immediately. Rod Hanscom, who was the Libertarian candidate, had lived in Texas and I think Seattle, Washington. And then a few years ago moved back to this horrible place that he identifies as this horrible place. It's badly mismanaged, has chronic structural problems. It's always a little counterintuitive to me that people move here having identified this as an inadequately managed place. The other thing that I'll say is, and not, you know, I don't know, not to be invidious about this, but, you know, a lot of people are moving to places that are going to be disproportionately affected by climate change. You know, I mean, if you're moving somewhere along kind of that hurricane belt from the Carolinas south to Florida, you're going to be disproportionately affected by climate change that way. And obviously, hot places will get hotter. One thing that the Lamont administration can do is have at least sensible internal climate change policies. Obviously, we can't affect global climate change by the way we live in Connecticut, but we can have infrastructure and hardening off of the state so that some of the things that are going to plague a lot of places maybe plague us a little bit less. There are ways in which we can play for the future here and already have and enjoy kind of an advantage being located in what will probably continue to be a fairly temperate zone.
Yeah, a temperate zone. And thanks to Long Island, probably not quite as bad as some other places, Susan. But given this really stark report that got delivered on the day after Thanksgiving in what was perhaps the ultimate news dump, but we're still paying some attention to, the Trump administration put out a report that basically said, yeah, all the things you'd heard from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change in the past, yeah, those are all pretty much true. America is in some trouble. And the place that's in the most trouble is the Northeast. We're warming faster. Our waters are warming faster. We're going to see more impact here. So even if local policies from a Democratic governor and Democratic legislature aren't going to turn around the global problem of climate change, it seems likely that at least the mitigation or adaptation aspects are something we should probably take pretty seriously.
Well, yeah, of course it is. I think we're going to see a lot of really big changes. You think about how the weather has been here for the past 10 years or so. It's always felt like it's been a bit off, and that's just going to continue. It's going to accelerate. We're going to see stronger storms. We're going to see colder or warmer winters. We're going to see just big changes, I think, that are going to make a big difference in our lives. But it's really hard, I think, for government to prepare for this because it's so abstract. Even now, as we're starting to see some of the effects, they don't know what they're preparing for. They don't really understand it, I don't think, and they don't believe that necessarily it's going to be as bad as it might be. So while they should be preparing, I don't think that necessarily they're going to be all that good at preparing for it. We're going to be reacting instead of actually trying to anticipate. And this has been our problem all along, that we're just reacting to climate change instead of preparing for it.
My bottom line is I always dreamed of having shoreline property. I'll stay inland.
I was going to say, my house in Simsbury is going to be great shoreline property not so terribly long from now. Well, this messaging that we were talking about on the Republican Party column, in which part of the message is taxes are too high here, the state isn't managed very well. Some of those things may very well be true. It didn't seem to work out too well for them in this past legislative election. Right now, Republicans are down to 59 state House seats. Democrats hold 92. There was an even split in the Senate. Now it's 23-13. An awful lot of the more conservative Democrats aren't there anymore. It seems as though the GOP is in a little bit of a tight spot here, given some of the trends that we were just talking about. What do they do to get out of this?
Well, yeah, they're sort of in the opposite of a tight spot because, I mean, there's really not much of a way for them to make themselves meaningful. They sort of have two choices. One of them is to make alliances with the most like-minded people that they can find among the Democrats or sit as many things. I mean, the option that they're probably going to choose, unfortunately, is to be the kids in the cafeteria leaning against the wall at the high school dance, making fun of the people who are out on the floor dancing. Because they see that as a more effective strategy. In other words, don't participate or participate minimally in attempts at remediation and then claim defeat of the other side. I'm kind of hoping that they don't do that. Lamont is, I think, working pretty hard to set a tone where that doesn't happen. His policy summit yesterday included Aaron Stewart, who's also on his steering committee, but also Thad Gray was there. I think Rob Simmons was there. There were Republicans there. He's trying to get people in the room, have some conversations about how things can be better. I don't think that you could really look at the results of this last election, as you just suggested, and say that strategy, which is kind of what they adopted this time too, you know, they didn't really fully participate in seeking solutions with the Democrats, and then they sort of blamed the Democrats for everything. I don't think that resonated very well. There were a lot of reasons why they lost those seats. There wasn't just one reason. There was the Trump problem. There was just the fact that they outworked on the ground an awful lot of older candidates who'd been kind of hanging around for a while and maybe took things for granted. I mean, there are a lot of reasons why any Senate seat or House seat flips. But somewhere in there is this idea that they haven't really presented themselves as the party of solutions. They've presented themselves as the party of complaint and grievance, but not necessarily a party stepping forward to say, and here's what we would do about it.
Well, and Colin just mentioned, Susan, Aaron Stewart, the mayor of New Britain, who had a very brief run for governor that didn't go terribly well for her, but she's seen as someone who's a bright, shining star amongst a kind of a littered field of potential candidates for governor in the future for the GOP. She's also someone who presents herself as a moderate. She leads a city that has an awful lot of Democrats in it. She comes from a political background. And her decision to be part of Lamont's transition team, if you followed along on Twitter, met with some, let's just say, resistance from her own party. People were just savaging her on social media for deciding to work with this incoming Democratic governor.
And boy, is that illustrative of the big problem that the Republicans have. Someone like Aaron Stewart, who is a moderate, who presents herself as being someone who is young and for change and has energy, et cetera, all this good stuff. Someone who was willing to meet with Ned Lamont and Barack Obama. They don't like her very much, the rest of her party, and they will go after her. The reason why her run for governor was so so ill-fated was because she just could not whip up the support, because that wasn't what the Republican voters wanted. That wasn't what the base wants. That's not what the people at the convention want. So her party is going in one direction, and she's going in another one. And if and she's got the – I think that she's got a more attractive message, trying to be, you know, more bipartisan, et cetera. And I just don't think that they're going to go for it. And doubling down on sort of conservatism and, like Colin says, the politics of grievance, it's not a, a good long-term strategy. I think we probably saw the limits of that strategy this year, especially with Bob Stefanowski's failure of a run for governor.
And not a good long-term strategy, Jerry, certainly in a state that has so many unaffiliated voters and a lot of registration this past cycle for more unaffiliated voters. What do you see as a future of a Republican Party that obviously in Connecticut looks a lot different as far as the electorate than the Republican Party in a lot of the rest of the country?
I think somebody like Aaron Stewart is the future of the Republican Party. I think this past election, you know, they were on that lovely carousel in Bushnell Park, reaching for the brass ring or the gold ring. And just when it was an inch beyond their fingertips, they fell off the horse, you know, and ended up far worse shape than they were going in. I like what I've seen from Ned Lamont so far. And my take on him is he's an entirely different person as governor-elect than he was as candidate. I thought he was a little bit wishy-washy as a candidate. But once he got elected, I've seen somebody much stronger, and I like what he's doing by being inclusive. Because you know what, if they don't start meeting in the middle, if they don't start coming up with consensus, the state's not going to get anything done.
Do you think that he actually has some ability, Colin, to get those Republicans who may be sitting at the back of the dance hall to come and join him on the dance floor, or are they still going to be too cool for school?
I think it's a lot to hope for them to be meaningful participants. But some of them may eventually be persuaded that it's in their best interest. And just to sort of amplify something that both Susan and Jerry have kind of gotten at here too, you know, Susan did a piece recently about our congressional districts. She talked about the 4th and the way that, you know, Stu McKinney and Chris Shays, you know, that type of Republican I would sort of lump Stewart a little bit in with that type of Republican. That type of Republican's done very well in the state of Connecticut. A little bit more consensus seeking, a little bit more tilting towards the center, a little bit more of a get along kind of person. Right now, the Republican leadership, they sort of need to find that tone a little bit. And I think Lamont is trying to make some room for them to do that. I also think they have to really be careful. I mean, you talked about Aaron Stewart getting beaten up on social media. I was watching that happening, and I was thinking, well, there's another Republican, at least one other Republican on the steering committee that I'm aware of. Now, cards on the table, he's a really good friend of mine, and he's on our board of directors, Greg Butler. Greg Butler was also on Dan Malloy's steering committee or transition committee, because everybody wants Greg Butler to be on their transition committee because he's really smart and he really understands government and everybody gets along with him. But you don't see people picking on Greg Butler because he's a powerful man. You see people picking on a woman urban mayor. You know, that's not a good look for the Republicans.
Nope.
They shouldn't be doing that. It once again makes it look like they're the white guy party. Don't pick on one of your prominent women. Don't do that.
Have a few of them, yeah.
And that's just to underscore the point that the problem that Republicans have is other Republicans. If they were to open up their primary process, it would actually help them a lot, I think.
There's been talk of it.
Yep. And if I know that they don't want to do it. The base certainly would hate that. But opening that up would actually, I think, lead to an increase of moderate Republicans actually able to win a primary, which they haven't been able to do at all in the last 10 years or so. It just has not happened.
Well, and to get back to Colin's point, you'd written about these formerly competitive congressional districts, the 2nd, the 5th, the 4th. These are places where Republicans could, maybe should do well amongst their own ranks, amongst independents. And over the course of the last decade, we just haven't seen them put up very strong candidates to take back these seats. What do they need to do to start running competitively in these congressional races? Because that's where a lot of the money from the outside is going to flow. That's what's going to energize the party. That's when the national Republican Party might actually take some interest in a different type of Connecticut Republican.
I think what voters are looking for, I think voters are who are willing to vote for Republicans in other races. There's kind of a latent Republican vote, especially in the second district, where there's lots of voters who are going to vote for like Bob Stefanowski for governor, or they'll support a Republican for Senate. But they won't support someone for Congress because they like their congressman or whatever reason. I think what those voters really want to see is someone who is going to reassure them, partly on social issues. They want to be reassured about somebody who's not sort of a nationalist like Trump. They don't want like hard right conservatism. They want somebody who's more openly moderate, someone who is more sort of openly bipartisan. Basically, if like a Rob Simmons were to come along, I don't think Rob Simmons. I don't think Rob Simmons could win a primary today. He didn't win a primary,
But I think the thing, Jerry, is that we treat the Rob Simmonses or the Aaron Storts as a type of Halley's Comet, that only every so many years we could possibly have one streak across the sky in the state. And I can't imagine that there aren't more Rob Simmonses or Aaron Storts who are coming from more conservative political ideology, but are willing to get into the political fray and maybe make some sort of change in the party.
Well, I read Susan's column, and you know, the second and the fourth districts, the second district is just wasted to the Republicans, where it used to be really tightly run when Simmons upset Sam Gaydenson, who seemed like a pretty safe choice, and then Joe Courtney came along and he beat Simmons by what?
78 votes, I think.
Maybe.
It was
something like
a handful
that.
Of votes, yeah.
And now, you know, a few years later, a couple of terms later, Joe Courtney's in there like Larson is in the first and like Rosa is in the third and the fourth district as well. I mean, you know, it's Fairfield County. You would think that the Republicans would have a much stronger base there than apparently they do now.
Yeah.
And I was really surprised to see how much blue has crept into the fourth district.
And that's a national trend, though. I mean, white, educated, more wealthy voters are actually trending towards Democrats now, and that's partly the Trump effect. But that's made that district much more solidly Democratic than I think it ever has been.
Well, we've still got five seats.
Yeah.
How much longer will we have five seats? We've gone from six to five.
Go back to the outward migration.
Yeah.
Given the trends earlier, I can imagine within our not too distant future going down to four seats. Colin, before we take a break very quickly, we got a Twitter message from Jeff Klaus, who is a conservative who listens to the program, and we're very glad to hear from him. He, you know, getting away from the congressional races back to the governor's race, he says, well, David Stemmerman put forth a number of specific proposals. No politics of grievance there. It's not as though the Republicans weren't running people who were kind of running away from Donald Trump and put out actual ideas, but they didn't get very much traction either.
Right. So, I mean, obviously that's on the Republicans to pick Stemmerman over Stefanowski. There were a lot of Republicans, prominent Republicans, who thought Stemmerman was the better candidate. So, I mean, they have to sort that thing out. Just quickly on the congressional districts, worth noting, we have redistricting coming up. It's coming up pretty fast. One thing that I would observe about the second district and is, because whenever we think about gerrymandering, we always think about it. We don't think about Jerry Brooks. We think about this really sort of cold, calculating stuff where, you know, these days the Republicans have gotten very good at using computers to maximize, get the most bang out of Republican strongholds or, you know, eat up some Democratic strength. It's still often done, though, in the, you know, naked exercise of ego and power. So the second district is actually a weaker district than it needs to be because over two cycles, basically, Rosa DeLauro, who has one of the safest seats in America, decided she needed Middletown, too. And Middletown, I think, after the 2000 census, was actually carved up, taken out of the second district where it could help a Democrat quite a bit, carved up a little bit, so a little bit of it went into the first and the rest of it went to Rosa. You know, if you were doing this with computers, you know, with some 28-year-old algorithm geek, you wouldn't do that. You only did that because a very powerful Democrat bigfooted the process to make sure she got more Democratic votes.
To your point, I'm not even sure what district I'm in right now. Could be the first or the second. I'm not sure.
And again, that may well be coming. You take a look at the map of Pennsylvania, how that's looked different after they were forced to redistrict away from gerrymandering, and that certainly made a difference in that state. We've got to take a break. When we come back, we're going to be talking talking about what the Democrats, now newly emboldened in the state legislature, are putting on their agenda. Maybe some things we've been hearing about but haven't gotten much traction in the last couple of years. We're talking with Colin McEnroe, with Susan Bigelow from CTNewsJunkie.com, and Jerry Brooks, former news anchor at NBC Connecticut. We'll be right back after this break in the Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. We're on Facebook Live today. You can find us on Facebook at WNPR Wheelhouse, also on Twitter, and you can find us online at WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. You can always call and talk to us about the week's news at 860-275-7266. We're joined today by Susan Bigelow, who's a contributor to CTNewsJunkie.com, and also Jerry Brooks, the former news anchor at NBC Connecticut, who's basically, since his retirement last week, has been hanging out in our lobby. And we said, come on upstairs, Jerry.
Really? I mean, please, I'm lonely. Help me.
Colin McEnroe is also here, of course. He is the host of The Colin McEnroe Show. Colin, what's on your show today?
Today we have a writer who's fascinated me for decades. His name is Nicholson Baker. He kind of blew everybody away, I think it was back in the 80s maybe, with a book called The Mezzanine, which was this unbelievably granular, Proust-like examination of just a day in the life of a cubicle slave, basically, and with, like, you know, 5 pages of descriptions of, like, how a stapler works and stuff like that. So anyway, he's coming to the Twain House, and yeah, let's do a whole show with Nicholson Baker.
Excellent. So Nicholson Baker this afternoon at 1 o'clock on the Colin McEnroe Show. We were talking about Republicans earlier. Let's turn to Democrats. Susan, we have a newly emboldened state legislature, maybe more progressives in the state legislature, certainly bigger numbers. Chris Keating from the Hartford Current writes, the Democrats could push a liberal agenda of tolls, minimum wage hike, and pot. Minimum wage hike and pot. I like that. I read that badly, didn't I?
Punctuation.
The punctuation is always the problem. But we're going to get to tolls in a second. First of all, is there a sense from you and your reading of the Connecticut State Legislature that now that you've got a Democratic governor and you don't have the split in the state Senate, that now there's just going to be all these things the Democrats have been waiting to do, raising the minimum wage, putting in tolls, making sure that we have marijuana just like Massachusetts?
They couldn't do these things like 2 years ago? When they did have a more of a majority, I don't know. I think that some of these things they're going to try and push. There's still such resistance about marijuana. There's a lot of Democrats who are just not sold. I think it's going to be a fight. I think that this is something that's not going to happen this session. Maybe 2 years from now, if Massachusetts goes well and the benefits are really clear, maybe then. But I just think that there's too much resistance at this point for that to happen. Minimum wage hike, maybe we'll see that. Again, though, this is the Democratic caucus is not really well known for getting things done in a timely manner. So I'll believe it when I see it. So I don't know. I mean, I think that they're full of energy. They want to get things done, but they always run into reality and time limits sooner or later.
Well, and that's the point. When you say time limits, like literally if they start talking about it now, maybe they'll get a vote by the end of this legislative session. And that's not even all that terribly likely.
No. I think that they always have a lot of big plans. This is what we see in every legislative session is that there's always big plans. They say, we're going to get this done by such and such a time. And they run out of time on it or it doesn't. They just descend into infighting over it. There's not enough votes for it. So I don't know. I think of these things to happen, maybe the minimum wage, but I don't know. I think that there's still resistance to that.
I don't know, Jerry. It looks to me like not only Ned Lamont, but some people in the state legislature might be looking pretty hard at what's happening in Massachusetts, about $2.5 million worth of sales of weed in just two little stores, one in Northampton, one in Leicester, Massachusetts. They actually had an emergency meeting in Leicester, Mass, yeah, because there's so much traffic and there's so many people standing in line. Now, this is a curiosity. It's something that we're talking about on this week's next program. There's really only two legal weed shops in the entire eastern seaboard of the United States. So, you know, this is going to maybe go away as a novelty, but it still potentially could mean an awful lot of revenue for the state of Massachusetts.
Pity the poor people of Leicester.
Yes.
I mean, really. I saw that story and you know, that sleepy little town, leave us alone. But everybody's flocking to Leicester. I don't see how you can look to Vermont, you can look to Massachusetts, and I believe, what, New Jersey now for marijuana?
Well, Maine has already legalized, but they're trying to institute the same sort of regime that Massachusetts has, and it's been sort of struggling in the state legislature. But you go up north in Canada, the entire country's doing it.
And really, how can you watch those tax dollars just go across state lines? You can't. Say it's sports betting in Rhode Island. I'm not a gambler, but you know what? If people are going to spend their money betting on sports, might as well keep it at home.
Well, one of the people that we talked to, and we had a whole lot of public radio reporters covering this story last week, Colin, which is, I suppose, not a big surprise. You know, some of the people are saying, look, if Connecticut's going to try to get more into the gambling business to try to keep people from going north to Massachusetts.
Connecticut is a casino. Really?
But there's already one casino. There's only one casino region, and they want to build more casinos. Well, you know, why wouldn't we do legalized pot to try to keep people from going there and buying that as well?
First of all, I do think the horse is out of the barn at this point. I think you're going to see a lot of these states fall like dominoes. Now, when the Connecticut domino falls is a big question. And I'll just sort of add to what Susan said about this. One of the interesting things about injecting some new blood into either chamber of the legislature is that they haven't been through the previous trial attempts. So the way things often get approved in the state legislature is you try it two or three sessions, you wear everybody down, you ultimately sort of, you know, lasso together this kind of coalition that will go along with it, and maybe on your fourth try you pass it. Now, all these new people, like Alex Bergstein from Greenwich and Julie Kushner from Danbury, they're all new. They haven't been through any previous trial attempts. They've never discussed this before, and they have some real questions about it. They have questions about its impact on children. Frankly, I mean, marijuana is an understudied drug. It's been around forever, but because of, in fact, restrictions on the way that it can be scientifically studied, it's actually a drug that's not very well understood. And so they've got some good questions that are fair questions. I'm sure those questions are going to get defined in certain ways as land of steady habits, can't make changes, everybody else is doing this, why aren't we doing it? We've got to do it, we're leaving money on the table. And all of those are, you know, they're legitimate concerns, but there's another set of concerns that balance them as well. And I kind of applaud some of these new legislators who are saying, I am not going to be rushed into something like this. This is a cultural change. That's a significant change. Just because two towns in Massachusetts are doing it, I'm not going to rush our state into it. Good for them, I say.
I think we have to remember sports betting and marijuana, we're really going to be making money off of people's addictions in a lot of cases. And we already do this, of course, with cigarettes, and we already do this with alcohol. But, you know, let's lay it out there. We're making money off of people's addictions. But, you know, is there a good moral case to make for marijuana legalization? And that's a little more complex. I mean, I think that there is, because the social cost of keeping it illegal is just too high. But still, that is, it's like Colin says, it's a complex issue. And there are a lot of different sides to consider.
I was just going to say that people who there are people who support all of those things, alcohol, tobacco, and certainly gambling. They'll say, well, these are vices, perhaps. These are not always addictions. Many people are faced with addictions, but not all. I mean, and so I don't think we can say we're just preying on people's addictions to gambling. It can be just a fun thing for an awful lot of people. I mean, I've certainly said my share of things negatively about the expansion of casino gambling in the state. But I think to say it's all about addiction, I'm not sure if that's exactly the case.
Well, I mean, I think that the people who are going to be generating the most money are going to be people who have a problem. And, you know, does the state really want to almost encourage people to continue with that problem by making it readily available?
Mm. When I said Connecticut is a casino, I go back. My days here start 1974. Hi-Li was the answer. We were going to get hundreds of millions of dollars from Hi-Li. We didn't have a lottery. Now we have I don't know how many games in the lottery. And then bingo. And the Indian reservations could sell cigarettes. And then the casinos. And now we would have put up a roadblock casino in East Windsor. I've really, that's all I can think of it. It's a roadblock. Every extension of any form of gambling has been embraced as the resolution to our financial problems, and we're are we now?
Yeah, and that's maybe really the issue, Colin, is that we keep coming back to something like this as an issue and yet as a solution, and we don't ever really solve the problem. And so maybe that is a bit of the definition of insanity.
The other thing is, I mean, we're all talking off of the piece that you referred to that Chris Keating did about the so-called Big Five. I'm not really sure there is a Big Five yet. I mean, once again, all these new legislators haven't showed up yet. They haven't been sworn in. They don't know where their desks are. I think it's a little early for that. You don't hear Marty Looney or Joe Arasimowitz talking about what the Big Five are. And because I think that's partly because they don't know yet what the Big Five are or what the major issues are going to be of this legislative session. I mean, this headline was their worst nightmare, right? It was something along the lines of the Democrats to push liberal agenda of tolls and minimum wage and pot.
Hike and pot, as I read.
So that's their, you know, that was exactly the headline that they don't want to have coming into the session, that they're pushing a liberal agenda. And I don't know that it's clear that they will push a liberal agenda. The first thing they've got to do is, once again, take another look at the finances of the state, see if you can get the ship to stop tilting so far to one side or the other, see if you can get it on kind of an even keel. Then this other stuff, you know, can be part of a larger conversation. But that conversation is going to take a really long time to have.
And by the way, the Big Five actually technically is a series of schools in and around the Philadelphia area that have long competed in basketball. I think UConn is hoping to join that as a better conference than they've been in the past couple of years. Quickly, I want to turn to one of those things in the Big Five, Susan. You've written quite a bit about tolls this week, and there's a big new study coming out about where all the gantries are going to be. Let's actually listen to our friend Max Reese from NBC Connecticut talking to DOT Commissioner James Redeker on his show Face the Facts this past weekend, talking about how other states do tolls and how we might do tolls.
Massachusetts has 13 gantries and 15 exits, one between every exit. Right. I-95 has 47 exits and 47 miles. You need to deal with it more as a traffic issue. The rates, we haven't set rates. The legislature would set rates. All we did was create an opportunity for discussion of what it might be if someone wanted to do it.
But the discussion maybe starts with this report that you were writing about, Susan, and it shows, well, there'd be an awful lot of tolls and an awful lot of roads.
Yeah, the thing that got shared around was this map that showed toll gantries on every single highway in the state. You know, on Route 2, for example.
I was stunned when I saw that in your article.
And there's so many of them. It's everybody freaked out. Everybody's looking at, like, oh, no, there's going to be, like, four toll gantries between my house and Hartford or wherever. And you think, well, I'm going to have to pay all this money. Oh, God. So everybody's freaking out about the idea of tolls and having to pay tolls. Of course, this is just a possibility, a study. This is probably not going to be anywhere near what the final proposal is going to be. But I do think that tolls as part of the budget solution, that's probably going to happen in one form or another. I just think it's unavoidable at this point. It's worth pointing out that the study did set the toll rates as at much, much lower levels than other states around us, much lower than Massachusetts' rates, much lower than New Jersey, certainly New York. So it wouldn't cost as much money to go from, say, Waterbury to Danbury as it would if that were in New York and there was a toll there, for example. But still, I think it's going to be a really, really bitter pill for people to swallow.
Two interesting things I saw in there. One, it presupposes that the HOV lanes that currently exist in and around the Hartford area would not be tolled. People would be able to continue to use the HOV lanes without having any sort of tolls. And secondarily, that there'd be a kind of a commuter discount. So if you use the roads more frequently, you could get a better rate, which seems to cut against the entire idea of trying to keep people off of busy highways.
The study didn't seem like it had a point to it. Like, why are you tolling? Are you tolling just to get money? Well, that's not going to go well because you're going to have a traffic nightmare. So why are you really going to toll here? Are you trying to get people off the roads, for example? Then in that case, then you have to do things like congestion pricing. And, you know, they did this a little bit. They said there'd be like a peak charge where you cost more money. Of course, if there's a peak charge but you have a commuter discount, then I'm not sure that really, you know, that doesn't really make a lot of sense. Certainly putting tolls on the HOV lanes, that's something I've heard a lot. People seem like they're more comfortable with that. So you could take the HOV lane, pay the toll if that's your choice, so you could get downtown a little faster, for example. The other part of this that I thought was strange was that they also talked about, well, we'll have all this money, so we'll add capacity to the highways, which means we're going to add lanes to them.
This is the sound of me hitting my head against the microphone.
yeah, same. The problem is that widening the highways is not a traffic solution, because then more people will be encouraged to use the highways. So you end up with the same traffic problem that you have. You could add 10 lanes to I-91 in both directions. Oh, God, you could. But you'd still have the same traffic nightmares because it wouldn't actually solve things in the long run. So really what we need to do is we need to look at public transit solutions. We need to look at congestion pricing. We need to look at just ways for people to be willing to get out of their cars and take something else to work.
But one of the things that this study does, at least, Jerry, is it starts us thinking beyond just the rhetoric of the campaign, which is tolls bad or tolls good or tolls neutral, which is all we were basically hearing. And now at least we can get into some details about what tolls will probably look like when they almost inevitably come.
Well, I don't think they're going to look like what, you know, Susan's column said they would look like, because they're everywhere but my little cul-de-sac.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure they will eventually come to some sensible conclusion. Whether I'm alive to see it when they finally do is another question.
Colin?
All right. I should like to point out, just in reference to your setup there, John, that Senator Frankenstein actually lost his election in Killingly. Tool's bad. Tool's bad. He's not coming back this year. So, there needs to be some clarity of thinking about this, and I think Susan's done a really good job of kind of laying that out. First of all, is this just a revenue issue? Is it simply an issue of other states are raking in money for as our drivers, you know, head into New Hampshire or whatever? Let's do the same thing. We have to acknowledge it's not going to be a huge amount of money. You know, it's not going to be a sort of fix the budget amount of money. It's going to be a helpful amount of money, but that's about it. If we have a goal beyond that, then we need to have a clear conversation about that. In other words, what do you want people to do? You guys have just illustrated, if you don't want people to drive on the roads going into the cities during the most congested times, then you make it less attractive, not more attractive. One thing they do in lots of other places too is the thing that you alluded to, Susan, like in Dallas. If you want to go in the fast lane, you pay more money. You know, if you've ever rented a car out of the Dallas airport with a GPS or tried to use your phone, what happens is your GPS just sends you onto this road that costs like $18 a mile to be on or something. but I mean, that's a thing you can do, right? If that's what you want to do, give people the option to move really fast and let the 1%ers pay a lot of money for it, or the 10%ers pay a lot of money for it, then that's a strategy. But I think you need a comprehensive strategy first. Is it just a revenue thing, or is it the beginning of a new way of trying to engineer traffic? What do you want people to do? Do you mostly want them to, if possible, leave their cars and take the train? What is it that you're trying to get to? And so I'll just say one last thing. It'll be interesting to see whether Redeker stays as Lamont's head of DOT, or whether Lamont goes and gets somebody with a particular kind of track record around these kinds of issues. That'll tell you a lot about at least where he thinks it's going.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we've got a couple phone calls, people raising interesting points. We're also going to celebrate Festivus a little bit early here on the Wheelhouse. We're going to try to find out what grievances perhaps you have, and also celebrate some feats of strength with Colin McEnroe, Susan Bigelow from CTNewsJunkie.com, Jerry Brooks, longtime anchor of NBC Connecticut. We'll be right back after this break in the Wheelhouse. This is the Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky, talking about the week's news with Jerry Brooks, Susan Bigelow, and Colin McEnroe. Got a couple phone callers who want to talk about a few things that we've talked about so far. So let's go first to Mike in Hebron. Hi there, Mike.
Hi, how are you, John?
Doing well. What's on your mind?
You know, I just had to say to Susan Bigelow, I mean, I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of people this air station reaches, but to come out with a very canned response and saying that addicts are going to keep the marijuana industry going and, like, assimilating that to gamblers who gamble. You know, I spent 4 hours on Good Friday up in Northampton at Medicare, and I have two questions. One, have you been there? And number two, I guess it's more of a statement. You should really go before you start criticizing what the type of income that could really mean for the state of Connecticut. I know it's not a fix-all, and I know it's not going to solve all our problems, not by a long shot.
Well, Mike, thanks for the phone call. Let me get a quick response from Susan. Thanks so much.
Yeah, I understand that. And I do think that there is an issue with addiction. We do have to face it. I don't think that that's going to be all of the users, certainly not. But I think it is going to be there's going to be heavy users who do generate a lot of income. So we can't just say it's purely a good thing. We can't just say it's purely a bad thing. There's a lot of complexity there, and I'm just saying we need to wrestle with it.
Yeah, and the complexity is, I think, in Connecticut, what has kept it on the back burner in the legislature for such a long time, because people are trying to deal with all these things. Something we didn't even mention is it's really hard to figure out who is impaired while driving, because there's not the same sort of roadside test that you have for alcohol, et cetera. But, Mike, I really appreciate your point. Ron's calling from Prospect. Hey there, Ron. What's up?
Hey, how are you guys? Excellent show.
Thank you.
And the Mianus River Bridge taxes, the gas tax was going to fix everything too, you know?
We remember.
On Jerry a little bit, if I could.
Long time
listener. Congratulations on your retirement. I'm kind of like Jerry, but I'm kind of Jerry plus 11. We were not a really big change in a really big difference in age, but I've been retired in the state for 11 years, and I can see Jerry sitting in his rocking chair 11 years from now thinking, gee, you know, the cost of my medical care has gone out of sight. My retirement is basically fixed. I'm not getting any pay raises. I'm kind of thinking about what's going to be happening for, you know, my later years. Probably going to be looking at an assisted living situation somewhere where, gosh, yeah, 11 years ago it cost $6,000 to $7,000 a month. But maybe we can afford that for a little while. Maybe we can't. And then we can look forward to going into a nursing home, probably under Title 19, because we've totally spent down all of our resources.
I think I'm going to kill myself right now.
Jerry's never coming on this show again. Well, thanks a lot.
Hey, Ron, I'm going to leave it there just because we only have a couple of minutes left. But I just like a quick question. I hear where you're going with this, and I get it that maybe, Jerry, in 11 years of being retired, you may have a different view of life in Connecticut with the high cost of living.
I can't say I'll be here.
Yeah.
I'll get back to you. I just want to be alive in 11 years. That's my immediate goal.
Okay. Well, you're here now. Ron, thank you very much for your phone call. We're going to try something new in this last segment, only last couple of minutes left, as we celebrate Festivus in advance. We're going to ask for a feat of strength or perhaps an airing of grievances. And we'll go first to you, Jerry. What is yours for this week? Something that you really want to talk about that's positive or something? Maybe you want to grumble
something
about.
Something positive. Here we go real quick. Barry Gordy is 89 today. I want to thank him for the music, part of the soundtrack of my life.
Very nice.
And especially Levi Stubbs of the Four Tops. Love his voice. The other is John Alan Chow. Don't go where you're not wanted. John Alan Chow was the missionary who went to that island hundreds of miles off the coast of India and got shot by bows and arrows and buried by people who just wanted to be left alone. Don't do that. It's stupid. And be very careful about gender reveals now, too, based on what we saw yesterday with the gender reveal that turned into a 700-acre forest fire.
So a few interesting airings of grievances.
I know. It's off the reservation.
No, I love this. No, this is good from Jerry. How about you, Susan?
Okay. So I have a positive thing. The new Doctor Who is really good.
Mm-hmm. I like her.
Yeah, she is fantastic. If you haven't watched Doctor Who in a while, the Doctor has regenerated. She is a woman, and she's really great. So I'm really enjoying Doctor Who. It's fantastic. Other British TV I'm really loving right now, of course, is The Great British Baking Show, which you should all watch. My grievance is that I take the bus to work a lot, and my bus is always late. And there's only one bus that will take me home to Enfield at night. And my bus that connects to work from there is always late, so I'm always stressed out. And I really wish that bus would get there on time. So that's my very petty grievance.
It's not petty. It's actually a grievance that I think a lot of people have, and a grievance that is well-founded. Colin, how about you?
Well, I mean, not to pile on an already suffering program, but the UConn Huskies football team went 1-11 this season. But most importantly, they broke records. They gave up the most yards, more than 7,000, the most yards per game, more than 617, the most points and the most points per game of any major college team in NCAA history. And the only thing I want to say about this from a public policy point of view is I think we need to kind of throw a rope around this situation a little bit. I mean, we're constantly being told, keep our little, you know, pencil necks out of this. This is football. You don't know what you're talking about. Randy Edsall needs some room to operate. Of course he has to have his son on the coaching staff, even if it seems to violate our norms about nepotism. And I think this program, which is has cost a lot of money to run and hasn't delivered very many successes can be called in on the carpet and forced to explain itself a little bit more.
Do you mind if I throw my alma mater, UMass, in with that? Because I'm with you.
Well, and yeah, UMass got into this football game even later and has even more of a problem than UConn has right now.
Even more ill-advised.
More ill-advised. So that's something we'll keep coming back to. I'm going to end the program with a feat of strength. It's hard to do something well. It's really hard to do something well for a very long period of time. And it's really, really, really hard to do something well for a long period of time and have people really like you on the way out. We've been joking with Jerry Brooks for the last week because people made quite a bit of his retirement from NBC Connecticut in 44 years on the air here.
Here's a ratings period.
But I will say, it is unusual in our business to have so many people come forward and say such nice things about the work that somebody does and so many nice things about the careers that you've influenced. So thank you, Jerry, for all of your work for all of us. And I really do wish you a very happy retirement.
Thank you. I appreciate that very much. I'm happy that I survived and I'm happy that nobody told me to take a long walk off a short pier on Facebook. So
we'll be hearing more from Jerry Brooks, late of NBC Connecticut. Also, Susan Bigelow from CTNewsJunkie.com and our own Colin McEnroe. Thanks to everyone who puts together The Wheelhouse here on WNPR.